Thank you, microdose.com. That's all I have to say right now. I have been traveling so much, planes, cars, like long, long drives. My body hurts, you know, sleeping in different beds, in different hotels, you know, everything's kind of screwy. And thank you, microdose.com. I know you've heard the word microdose before, but this is microdosing THC. And microdose gummies deliver perfect entry-level doses of THC that help you feel just the right amount of good. And you deserve to feel good. You can go to their website, microdose.com, and learn all about microdosing THC. But I'm telling you, it is amazing. They have all different strains that help with all different issues. A friend of mine just sent me a photo of her with her order from microdose.com saying thank you. I'm telling you, a lot of people do this, all sorts of people. And they do it to feel healthier. They do it to perform better. They do it to focus. They do it to sleep. They do it for pain. They do it for relaxation. It really helps your mind and body be at peace. So really check it out. Microdose.com is amazing. And the product, they taste delicious, number one. But the product is so damn good. And you deserve to feel better. So what are you going to do? You're going to go to microdose.com. If you don't already know, you're going to learn about microdosing THC. And when you get there, you're going to get 30% off your first order plus free shipping today at microdose.com. Promo code Judy Gold. It is available nationwide. That is microdose.com, promo code Judy Gold, J-U-D-Y-G-O-L-D, for 30% off and free shipping. That is a lot, 30% off. And the stuff is amazing. I'm telling you, microdose.com, promo code Judy Gold. You're welcome.
Well, I don't see the point in waiting any longer. Let's bring her out. The star attraction, the one you came to see. Ladies and gentlemen, the one, the only, Ms. Judy Gold.
Hey everyone, I am very excited today because, I'm always excited when I have guests that I really like, which is pretty much all I have. Anyway, so today is a very special episode of Kill Me Now. Because I think I'm one of the only people who was interested in interviewing our guest after the fucking orange piece of shit left. And I just, you know how I am. I like to get to know what makes people tick. So I'm really excited that today's guest on Kill Me Now, and I did wash my hair for this, is the one and only Noel Kassler, everybody. Woo! Okay. Noel, I'm annoying myself already. Thank you for coming on. I can't believe it.
Thanks for having me, Judy. This is an honor, man. I'm just scared. I love you.
I love you. Ding. So Noel, here's the deal. You know, I do a lot of research on my guests, and I was listening to some interviews, and this one interview was calling you a Twitter writer, and I wanted to punch. What the fuck is a Twitter writer?
I know. Oh,
I know. You remember him?
Yeah. A pretentious San Francisco, like, literary place. Yeah.
Yeah.
Twitter writer. Exactly.
Yeah. Our next, our guest today is Twitter writer, Noel Kassler. I mean, that means everyone's a Twitter writer, you know?
I know. It was completely stupid. He booked me, like, it was a literary program, and I think he realized then I didn't have a book.
Right, but you're writing a book. You're writing a book right now. Right. And then, someone probably got in trouble, but he really seemed, I mean, it was a good interview, but it was like, shut up. I hate pretentious people. They're so fucking annoying. Okay. So Noel, a lot of people know you because you are a Twitter writer, but you have a pretty interesting life. Like, first of all, your parents had you when they were 19 years old. That is crazy. Now I am fascinated by this because my parents were 41 and 48. And so I was the complete opposite at a time when that was not normal. Now that's normal. And your parents were, they were at college, right?
Yeah. Washington College on the Eastern Shore of Maryland. And they had me at 19 and they named me after Jimi Hendrix.
Jimi Hendrix. Yes. You're named after, you think I didn't do Noel Redding.
Yeah. Exactly.
And did they stay in college?
My mom dropped out to do my dad's homework. He wasn't a good student. So she dropped out because of the pregnancy, did his homework for him. He graduated. And then, you know, they split up a few years later. It was like the maelstrom of the late 60s. I was born right. in 71. So it was still right. the early 70s, but very much the hippie kind of overindulgence thing.
How like typical is that? That your mother, obviously brilliant, smart, is taking care of a baby and doing your father's homework and then gets fucking booted.
Right.
Do they talk, your parents?
Not anymore. No, I don't think they've talked for a long time. And my mom had my dad left when I was like 4 or 5. And then I lived with my mom, who was a single mom, struggling with who she was. You know, this was the 70s and she had a lot of issues and stuff. So she sort of lost touch with my father, I guess would be the best way to put it, and just raised me on her own as best she could till she could no longer, you know?
Right. So your parents are in college. What were they studying?
My mom was an English major. She was a great, you know, very literate, very good writer.
Are you? Because you're a Twitter writer. They know.
Exactly. they were both Army brats. Both of their parents were in the Foreign Service. My grandfather on my father's side was like Nixon's envoy to Vietnam.
Yes, Harry S. Kassler.
Wow, you
was.
Really
I do it all. He was an officer. He was attached to Nixon, pretty much, and he would have Thanksgiving with Westmoreland, he would have drinks with the Nixons in Cherry Hill before Thanksgiving.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I just love that I reading about your grandpa and your other grandfather was in the NSA.
Yeah, he was an NSA guy and like an Irish Catholic guy from Massachusetts who went to World War II and was in intelligence, and then the Navy put him through Harvard. And he basically learned like this ancient form of Arabic that they used to communicate in the Mideast. So he spent his whole career translating, you know, intercepting spy cables and
right.
stuff. So my family lived in Cyprus and all over, you know, the Mideast. And then, so they were both essentially army brats, you know, foreign service right. brats who met in college.
But high up in the, like pretty high up,
yeah.
you know, exactly. So. It's interesting. I find it fascinating that your grandfather, who worked for Nixon, he quit after their trip to Venezuela, where he had asked Nixon to take a different route, not to go through the city.
Wow.
And he asked him to take a different route so that it would be safer. And Nixon, a fucking narcissist, said, no, I want to go through the main city, and they were bombarded. And the car, I looked up, the car was fucking trashed.
Yeah. Yeah. They were rocking the car, you know, and like it had American flags on it. It was like the presidential limo. And my grandfather right. was in the back, like attacking Nixon, like, you asshole, I'm never going right. to see my kids again because of you. You know, and then they had one more falling out over the bombing of Cambodia.
Right.
And my grandfather was like, my grandfather was an intelligence officer in Dresden, like telling them where to drop the bombs. And, you know, so he was like, I did some crazy stuff for this country, but we can't be bombing Cambodia. Like this
right,
is
bullshit. Right.
We've lost the war. Kissinger had Nixon's ear at that point and wanted right. to help Nixon get reelected and was like, screw you, we're doing it. So my grandfather left and became an expatriate and moved my family to County Cork, Ireland.
That's so amazing. I mean, when I was reading about him, I was like, oh my God, he's just like his grandfather. I mean, you know, the fact that he was like, you know, fuck it, I'm not going to play this game anymore. Your parents were, I mean, you know, when you think of army brat, you think of like, oh, he's just in the army and they go from base to base. But you know, we're talking, you know, did they go to the White House? Did your father know Nixon?
Yeah. And they remember like Westmoreland at Thanksgiving dinner. And my grandfather would walk into the Oval Office, like his GS.
So who would be like in the administration now, who would be your father?
Oh, that's a good question. It would be,
your grandfather, I'm sorry.
Right. It would be like a senior aide. I don't even know if they have that type anymore, you know, because it was like back then people didn't advertise who they were. Like you worked for the Foreign Service. Really, you were like a CIA agent, you know.
Right.
My grandfather was in Panama. He was in, you know, Malaysia. Like they were in all these crazy places where there was like subterfuge happening beneath the surface, you know.
Right.
And I can't believe that research you've done. I'll share one more thing on them. They lived in New York for a while in a townhouse, and their best friends were the Benchleys. Nathaniel Benchley, who was Robert Benchley's son, and the Hemingways lived on the other side of them.
Oh my God.
And my grandmother lived in Paris before that, and her roommate was Julia Child, who taught her.
No fucking way. Yeah. I fucking love Julia Child.
I know you do.
First of all, I'm on a ball. That's why I keep going like this. But Julia Child, first of all, my mother loved her. Tall.
Yeah.
And also she was a spy. She was a fucking spy. And I fucking loved her. Oh my God. That's Noel. You're from like royalty.
Well,
and then your parents fucked it all up for you. That's great.
You know what my mom ended up doing, right?
What?
My mom robbed 8 banks and went to prison when I was in 7th grade.
Okay, that I didn't get to. That is very interesting that I didn't.
But anyway, so it's a weird paradox.
Right.
You know? Cause she was, you know, she had some, that's another story, but I'm happy to talk about it. But it was interesting to come from that. Like you would have these Christmas dinners where my grandmother would be deboning a turkey, you know, cause Julia taught her how to do that.
Right.
And we'd be in some Foreign Service officer's house in like Chevy Chase, Maryland or Georgetown, you know, these swanky things. But then, you know, this was the 70s and my family was in denial about like my mom, you know, she had alcoholism and substance abuse and they sort of just were in denial about it.
Right.
So I would go back to this like wrong side of the tracks neighborhood where I lived with my mom in like a Brooks Brothers suit.
Right.
You know, sort of straddling both these worlds. And it was disorienting as a kid, but it was the best blessing I ever got.
Right. Because you got to see.
I got to see
sides of the equation. Yeah.
Right. And I saw how unfair it was, which is kind of a theme of my life and work now. Cause I lived in a, what they called a black neighborhood back then, you know, and it was, you know, it was black and Latin and a lot of Palestinians. And these were my best friends and I lived amongst them and they would bus us into these leafy suburbs where we'd go to school with all the kids who looked like me.
Right.
And it was just a weird paradox. And I, you know, I saw it cause then I was, after my mom kind of bottomed out, which was the best thing that ever happened to her. Cause then she was, you know, she came out in prison. My mom, you know, I had after that 2 moms and I'm very proud to be, you know, the son of somebody who found her truth and started living it, you know, at a time where she was still conflicted, but it was interesting to sort of have an upbringing that was like privileged, not privileged. And then in high school, I was in Westchester, like, which was
You had Lakeland High School. You went,
So
here, your memories, your earliest memories, like you say your parents divorced when you were 4.
Right.
Then did you not see your father?
I mean, I would see him like, I don't mean to cut
you. To Woodstock, I read, right? Yeah.
Wow, it's crazy. It's like this is your life.
I'm obsessed with people. Like I really, if you're gonna spend an hour or something, I should, you know, I just think it's
I know, I agree. Yeah, I read your book in preparation for this and it was
Thank you.
It's incredible. We've worked together too. We just never saw each other in person, but like Home for the Holidays in 2015 and a cooking show a long time ago.
Yeah.
So I would spend summers with my dad, who was like a trustafarian, I would call it, you know, because he came from means and never had to really work. So he would be like, I'm growing organic mung beans in Woodstock this year. And I'd go to visit him and he'd be like living in a tent on Todd Rundgren's farm.
No way.
Yeah, we lived in a tent on Todd Rundgren's farm for like a whole summer and stuff.
You and your dad.
Yeah, me and my dad in a tent.
That is fucking hilarious.
It was crazy. It was crazy.
Yeah, but I bet you bonded. So you'd spend the rest of the year with your mom and then go visit your father in Woodstock. And then did you have a relationship with your grandparents still?
Absolutely. Both of my grandfathers have passed away now. My grandmother maternal is still alive.
Right.
The one I lived with Julia Child passed away. Right. But I had, relationships with them my whole
life.
What
a psycho childhood. I mean, you saw everything.
It was bizarre.
So your parents divorce and then where you go to... You know, you go to school, right? But so there's no money left from your grandfather to your mother?
No, because My other grandfather, who was like in the NSA, was sort of just in denial about it. My mom's a huge fan of yours too. She's
going
to love it. So, you know, he was around, and my mom was good at making it look like things were better than they were. You know, we'd go to my grandfather's on Sunday for dinner, you know, in Columbia, Maryland, my paternal grandfather. And it was like, oh, everything's fine. But, it wasn't fine.
It was far from fine.
And she would get DWIs. And there was all kinds of signals that, you know, were never dealt with. And then she ended up literally robbing banks.
So, obviously, the robbing of the bank is a cry for help. It's so... Like, it's just, how did she run? All right. First of all, how old are you when she robs the bank?
I'm 13. I have no idea that she's doing this.
Where are you living? You're living in Maryland still. Okay.
In Maryland. We'd sort of like.
What kind of neighborhood? In your neighborhood you described before?
We moved up out of kind of the rougher neighborhood into a less rough neighborhood. She married a hippie drummer guy. Still trying to find herself. Like, all her friends were gay. You know,
can I just say. You know, as a gay, you know, people don't, and young gays don't realize this. Like, it was a mental illness. Like, if you lived your truth, you could lose everything. I mean, that was the message. You know, we weren't represented, and you'd be not only shunned by your family, but employers. You couldn't get an apartment rented, you know, literally because of who you love, which is the way you're fucking born, you know? And so it's just, when you hear these stories of the struggles, you know, we can't forget, because there's so many, you know, LGBTQ, RSTUV, kids who are just, whatever. And it's like, no, you got to know your fucking history. And these are the people, there's more than one of your mother around.
Absolutely. And I'm glad you say that, because it's important. I see it in this younger generation, and I'm happy how free they are to be.
Right.
But like, it was a secret society. Like, we go out to like the Castro district in San Francisco in the summers and meet all her friends. And they'd have these parties in Marin County, you know, like up in the hills where they could be themselves, because you had to be. Even in San Francisco, this was the era of Harvey Milk and all this stuff. And those are some of the bravest men and women I've ever met.
Oh, you're not kidding. Especially Harvey.
I know. Exactly. Exactly.
Whose only message. Wait, shit. I forgot the Jew bell on Harvey. The only, you know, his one message, and it rings true today, is come out of the fucking closet. Unless you come out of the closet, no one knows that they love a gay person, you know?
Hey, everybody. If you know me, you know I love my Liquid IV. And I love giving it to people and telling people about it. And it's part of my everyday life. I keep hydrated with Liquid IV. I put it in my water bottle. Well, I have this one water bottle that I use only for Liquid IV. And I put lots of ice in it and cold water because I like it very cold. And it keeps me hydrated and it's delicious. So thank you, Liquid IV. And I have to tell you, I've now given it to my son's girlfriend because, you know, they go out partying. You know what I'm talking about. And it has helped her immensely. With her dehydration, that it's great for those nights where you know you're going to be having a few drinks. It's delicious. It comes in pear, white peach, grape, lemon lime. Also, there's a lemon ginger one that is great that has a little caffeine. I just love Liquid IV. And you need to keep hydrated. It's very important. It affects you on so many levels. So do yourself a favor. Keep hydrated in the best way possible. Some people hydrate to live. Some people live to hydrate. I think I live to hydrate. Liquid IV quenches your thirst faster than water alone. It has 3 times the electrolytes of leading sports drinks, 8 vitamins and nutrients for everyday wellness. And this is true. They have a sugar-free stick. They have Liquid IV sugar-free that Elisa, my lover, loves. Whatever. But it's also been great for my traveling because I get very dehydrated on my airplane flights. So please, you've heard me say this multiple times. Go get your Liquid IV. You have to keep hydrated. It's very important. So however you hydrate, grab your Liquid IV Hydration Multiplier sugar-free in bulk nationwide at Costco, or get 20% off your first order when you go to liquidiv.com and use code JUDYGOLD at checkout. That's 20% off your first order when you shop Better Hydration today using promo code JUDYGOLD, J-U-D-Y-G-O-L-D, at liquidiv.com. You're welcome.
So you are 13 and you've moved up a little, but your mother has no money. Is that what's going on?
Yeah, still doesn't have any money. We're living in an apartment. Like, we don't have a working telephone. She's married to a random hippie drummer guy. Right.
Was he a good drummer?
He was all right. You know, right. What I mean? I have a funny joke about that. I won't do it, but, so one morning the FBI kicks down the door. They kick down my bedroom door. They're like, freeze, FBI.
No fucking way.
Yep. Guy holds a shotgun in my face. I'm sitting here under the covers, have no idea what's happening. I had a big poster of Keith Richards, you know, from the Rolling Stones.
Yes.
I love the Stones. And back then they had record stores and they'd give you the promo posters. God.
Remember that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
You just go in and be like, can I have that in 6 weeks? You know?
Yeah.
And, so I had this big poster of Keith Richards. And this FBI agent's looking down a shotgun, sees this kid there, and he's like, looks at the poster, looks back at me, goes, you like the Stones? And I'm like, yep. And he's like, all clear in here. And he just walks out of the room. There's no child services, nothing.
Okay. Were you fucking like, I would have shit in my pants. Like, were you freaking the fuck out?
I was kind of like, not really, because I was a little numb at that point. You know, I didn't know what my mom was up to.
Right.
I
detached. But you knew that there were issues at that point.
Yeah. And I knew the jig was up. It was like, whatever she did, she's done it now. You know,
did you have friends come over or were other parents like, don't go over to their house or his mother's fucking crazy.
Not at that point, but in younger stuff, you know, I had sleepovers and was in.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
She did her best to give me the best life she could. You know, she was a kid herself and struggling with her own.
And you never felt unloved.
No, I didn't. I had a lot of love. And that's why I turned out kind of okay, you know, because love is love, you know, and her friends loved me. You know, that's the other thing. Like, I was raised in many ways by the gay community. I'm certainly the man I am now because of the love that and parenting.
And it's also, you know, this is another factor that I'm sure your mother had to deal with, is that you had to choose your own. You had to make your own family because the other ones were, that was it. You're done.
Exactly.
Okay. Oh, that's good that you had that. All right. So anyway, so the FBI comes in. Yeah.
Yeah. So they drag her out. Like, she's in the bathroom.
Are you crying?
No. I was through crying at that point. I did a lot of crying in my childhood, but like, I was, you know, I was sort of like in my own world and like, what's going to happen? And they drag her out of this bathroom. You know, I just hear all the footsteps because the FBI is not trying to hear like I'm getting dressed.
Right.
They knock down the door. They drag her out. I wait till the smoke clears, you know, like 10, 15 minutes. I walk out in the living room. They didn't arrest the hippie drummer dude.
Oh, I was just going to ask you, is the drummer still there? Yeah. Okay.
He's still there. He's like, I'm going to go to a hotel now and kill myself. You can have my stuff. You know,
No way.
Yeah. I swear to God, you know, he leaves, you know. And I don't have a phone. So I'm like, fuck, what am I going to do? Like,
wait, they left a 13-year-old boy. Yeah. Oh, well, they thought the drummer was there. So, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And it's the early 80s. That's the other thing. Child Protective Services. Like, they would let her. She would get DWIs and they like practically give you a ride home. You know, it was a different era. So he leaves. And all I can think about is like, what am I going to do? And bizarrely, there was a lot of self-centered fear. Like, how am I going to look cool on Monday? Like you said, like how many of my friends saw that shit? Because it was I was a teenager, you know, I was worried about looking cool and it already had the childhood that I was already had secrets and was covering up. So I didn't know what to do. I turned on the TV, you know, day turned to night and Caddyshack came on the television. And I was just thinking like, what's going to happen? How am I going to look cool on Monday? I hope nobody finds out. And I can still never watch that movie. But, you know, back then they'd have commercial break at 11. And there's a picture of my mom in her disguise that they got from the bank. And they were like, Greenbelt woman arrested for robbing 8 banks or whatever. And I was
so
just like,
it's like the Patty Hearst thing.
Right.
Wait, so they show, what was she, did she have a wig and stuff?
Yeah, she had a wig and sunglasses and like glasses, right? But the last girl she had done it to, she had gone to high school with. And she was so high, she didn't realize.
God. So how would she rob the banks? Like, would
this is the interesting part. She would hand him a note, right?
Okay.
Yeah. So she would hand him a note and say, I have a hand grenade in my purse. Give me the money in the drawer, you know, or I'm going to detonate it. And she never had a hand grenade or anything. She had a note. So I like to tell people I come from a family of writers. Right. But so she would hand him this note. The last time she did it, she was so drugged out and desperate. She had been speedballing heroin and cocaine, you know, again, early 80s, you know, so she was mentally ill from addiction and sick. And that happened. I was rescued, you know, this happened right around Thanksgiving. By Christmas, I was living up here in Westchester with my grandparents and had the normal, you know, he put me in a polo shirt. I fit right in. You know?
Yeah. Look at that face. Yeah. Right. You're like one of the Von Trapp family singers. You know?
Exactly. And that being said, you know, prison helped her sober up. She got sober, went to AA, came out, had a girlfriend in prison, got out of prison. I moved back in with my mom.
Okay. All right. All right. So she goes to prison.
Right.
Do you visit her in prison?
Yes. Yes, I did. And she went to what they now call Camp Cupcake, which is where they sent.
Was that where Michael Cohen went or no?
No, he was in upstate New York. It's a female prison, you know, but.
Well, whatever. Is that where Michaela Cohen went? All right.
It's where, what's her name went? The Martha Stewart.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
She was in prison with Squeaky Fromm, you know, the Manson girl.
Oh yeah.
And they used to put on the White Album to mess with her, like as a big joke. God,
that's
and Squeaky would start freaking out and shit. But yeah. So I visited her in prison.
So you're like, at this point, you're eighth, ninth grade, right?
Right.
And you're living with your grandparents. So you have to move schools. So you can create a whole new identity. Is that correct?
You're good. Yes, exactly.
What do you decide on? Just like, you can't tell anyone the fuck why you're.
No.
So what did you do? What was your.
I was like a creative. I played music. You know, I'd been exposed to so much music that I had a head start on my peers in eighth grade that were just getting into Led Zeppelin. It was like, I lived that shit. You know what I mean? Like, and I played guitar and stuff. And then when I got around, like, there was a lot of girls up there that thought I was cute. So I very quickly kind of got into that side of things and was just like sort of off to the races on my own. People didn't ask me about it, you know, and this was now the mid, late 80s when I was in high school and it was its own crazy time. You know, I'd go down to the city at night. My uncle was a big writer in the city at the time for a magazine, her kid brother. And he would take me to concerts. Like I'd go see Miles Davis one night.
Wow.
I saw some really cool stuff.
Was your mother sort of the black sheep of the family then? Like,
100%. Yeah. It was like she wasn't mentioned. Now she's fully.
Okay.
Ingratiated. We're talking 30 something years ago.
Right.
This, you know, 35.
So,
years ago.
All right. So you're in high school. And so you seemingly have this normal, you're living with your grandparents.
Right.
Were they good parents?
Wonderful. Saints. Okay. Saints. Wonderful.
And you're going to high school. And what are you involved? Are you involved in theater? Because I know you went to the American Academy of Dramatic Art. So were you in the plays and stuff or?
I wasn't in the plays. I hadn't really found that part of myself yet. It was probably too sensitive to me to acknowledge, you know, I was more into like skiing and playing guitar.
Right.
Smoking cigarettes. You know, you could smoke in high school back then.
I remember. Right. Yeah. But, I smoked pot. We smoked pot in the band room, in the practice rooms. And we would take, like, we'd have a one hitter. We would make it out of a Coke can. And then we would cover the, you know, the window, whatever. And then we had a rag soaked in perfume and you would take the one hit and you couldn't let any smoke out and you'd blow it through the rag. It was ridiculous. You know, now they're just with their vape pens.
I know. Yeah. And gummy. No,
yeah. Yeah.
If they
exactly.
had pot gummy bears when I was in high school, I never.
Oh, forget it. Forget it. Okay. So do you feel like you had sort of a normal 4 years of high school?
I did. And I had what I had longed for when I was living with a single mom on the wrong side of the tracks, because I was basically raised by a television. You know, and shows like Eight is Enough and the Brady Bunch. And I wanted that bucolic.
Oh,
like,
of course. Right. Yeah, like, I wrote a show about that. Yeah, like I just wanted to run away. Wanted to run away to their houses, their homes. Yeah.
Just a physical house. I was like, you're rich. Like, I thought I was rich. Now I know my grandfather's parents were just middle class.
Right.
They lived in a house. You know, I was like, wow, a yard? So I'd manifested the life that I wanted, you know, and it was, there was a lot of blessings in that, you know. I got to kind of exhale.
Did you have any therapy at all during that?
I did. Oh, 100%.
Oh, good, 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 good. Did you ever feel like a fraud because you were given this new life and you were still, you still had this baggage, I guess, or like, I mean, you don't even know who the fuck you are in high school. And yet you've had these experiences that, you know, you should not have had as a young child. So did you have anyone that you could like confide in, or did you kind of hide it all and just.
I hid it all. You know, I would talk to my mom on the phone, like after school from the prison, she would call me and stuff. And there was a lot of shame. I'm not going to lie. Like it was.
Oh, of course.
Like, now I can talk. I talk about it publicly. Like I talk about this in things that I'm involved with that help people, you know, further than that. But like, you know, in recovery and things like that, like I share my story because there's a lot of kids going through that now. You know, the amount of people that are incarcerated now compared to back then is astronomical. But so there was shame. So I couldn't confide in any of my peers. My sense of humor had always been my survival mechanism because I was this little kid in this neighborhood. Like physically, I didn't stand a chance at like defending myself, but I could take you down verbally. You know, I had that.
Right. Oh, hello. Right. Yeah. Exactly. You know, that's what I say. In my book too. I mean, but it's like, you know, everyone is like, oh, comedy is the best medicine, but it's also a weapon. And that's why fucking, you know, insecure cowards that are orange can't even fucking deal with it.
Exactly.
It's Okay. So you graduate high school and then you have a few years before you go to the American Academy.
Right. Yeah. So I went to Vail, Colorado and I was a ski bum and like snowboarded every day and, you know, like partied, you know, drank beer and skied. And this was the late 80s, early 90s. Then I moved back to DC. My mom was out of prison at
this point. How long was she in prison?
It was less than 5 years. So it was like eighth grade to like by the first year I got out of high school, 89, she got
baby.
Out. So 5 years.
Wait, when she would call you, right, from prison, was it that fun, like you know how they have on TV where they do that recording phone call from prisoner number? Is that what really?
That's exactly. Yeah. Please hold. Prisoner is calling you from, you know, Alderson Correctional Facility.
I just want to hug you, poor baby. All right, go ahead.
Whatever. It's fine.
All right, so she gets out.
She gets out, and I have a lot of healing to do with her, right? So, you know, I'm resentful. You know, I'm the child of an alcoholic at this point, who sort of feels abandoned by their mom. And even though there's love there, there's a lot of work to do to repair a relationship like that. And the great blessing of that time was that she was now free to be who she was. So she had this great girlfriend who became like a second mom to me. And they had an apartment in DC and I would move in with them and their dogs. And I worked as a bike messenger. And
oh, that's so great. Wait, all right. So what did the girlfriend, did she met her in prison or no?
No. She had another prison girlfriend that was like,
did you ever meet the prison girlfriend?
Yeah, I did. And she was like what you would think the prison girlfriend was like.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was she was like hardcore from Arizona.
Right.
Like, you know.
What did she do? What did the prison girlfriend
I think she had done something violent. You know, I think she had was like a bike, you know, I don't know, shot a dude or something. Something hardcore, you know. My mom was like white collar kind of, you know, wouldn't know how to use a gun or, you know, there was no violence.
So the high school girl, just to go back a bit, the one that she goes to the bank and the teller is someone she went to high school with.
Right.
Is that's who told on her?
That's who dropped the dime on her, as they say in prison parlance. Yes.
But did she?
Was like, I know that person. Because we're in the same area where my mom went to high school. Like,
oh my God. What's your mom's name?
Michaelin. Yeah.
Okay. Michaelin, seriously, like go to a different area next time you're going to rob a bank. Okay. So did she know right then? Oh my God, I went to high school with this girl, or
she must've. I mean, she didn't discuss it with me. Right. I had no idea she was doing this. It was a complete shock to myself and my family.
You know what I'm going to have to say? I don't think your mother's going to the high school reunion.
Exactly. Exactly.
All right.
And the rest of my family heard about it on the news. That's how I got rescued, because we didn't even have a phone. I wasn't right. Like them picking me up. They were just weird. They heard about it on the news and swung by and got me.
It's so incredible that you think, when you say, you know, I didn't have a phone, how fucking addicted people are to their fucking phones. Right. And that, like, when I was growing up, we had one phone, but they're right. Like the really cool kids, they had their own line and their, you know what I mean? Or they had more than one line. But it's like you shared one phone. If someone was on it, too fucking bad, right. You know? I kind of liked the world a little better then.
I loved it back then.
I mean, you were in your head. You could fucking take a walk and it wasn't like bing, 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 bing. You know, I hate it. It causes me so much anxiety. I can't.
I'm with you. I'm addicted to my phone and I got to get off it. Twitter. Right. There was also romance back then. Like if you wanted to meet somebody and get their number, you had to show up. Right.
And yeah, it was like, meet me behind the school.
You had to write love notes, you know, we would write notes and pass them in high school. And that was your communication, you know?
And also all right, I'm really old fashioned, but the don't fucking, you know, write me a thank you note in a text or in an email. I want to go to the mailbox and I want you to write me a fucking, you know what I mean? I hate it.
I agree.
Okay. So the new girlfriend, your mother's new girlfriend, what's her name?
Her nickname is Eagle. Her name was Ellen. Is she still alive? They broke up, but her name's Ellen. But
was she Jewish?
No, she was Irish. No.
Okay, whatever. Ellen's kind of a Jewish name. There we go. Okay. So how did she meet Ellen?
In DuPont Circle, you know, Washington, D.C.
Right, like
in that area.
The gay area.
Yeah, exactly. My mom was, you know, in recovery at that point, so she probably met her at like a sober AA
meeting.
Gay AA. And they moved in together and I would stay with them. And then they got a farmhouse in suburban Maryland and had a potbelly pig and a couple and I moved in with them and that's when my acting career started. Cause you know, I didn't have to work to that career, but you know, that's when I started studying acting because I lived with them and waited tables at night and was able to save up money to go to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts and all that.
And at this time, has your mother come out to her family?
Yes.
And what did they do?
They accepted her. They loved her and accepted her. My family would have accepted her the whole time. I think it was more like
she was so tortured. Yeah.
Yeah. And as you so well pointed out, society was different. You know, now we're in the early 90s and people are, you know, they're high profile, you know.
Well, people, you know, it's an unfortunate that the AIDS crisis forced people to come out. Like I tell so many kids, you know, they couldn't be in the closet anymore because they'd walk out of their apartment. They had sores. They had wasting. And also the fact that these people are dying. I mean, this is going to a morbid place, but you know, they're dying in the hospital and they're not letting their fucking partner in, or the family's coming in at the end saying, sorry, you're not invited to the funeral and I'm taking all, you know, fuck you. That's why we have these rights. Assholes. Okay.
Absolutely. I saw all that, you know, like my mom's girlfriend, Eagle, her brother had AIDS. He was in that generation of men, was involved with Whitman Walker Clinic, you know, ACT UP. So I saw, that's why I say these are the bravest guys you've ever seen.
Right.
Like the fact that you already have to live that way from Stonewall to the AIDS era.
Right.
Like, nobody got like a harder chunk of thing. And I'm not saying this to pander, but like these were the nicest, most loving, unbowed people. Dudes who had a death sentence that were fighting to just be acknowledged by Reagan and get medical care, still loving and smiling and taking to the streets.
Yeah.
And that was a wonderful thing to see, you know.
And it brought the, you know, look, the lesbians do not get enough credit, the women who stood by these guys. So there's a whole story there. Yeah. But it definitely brought the community together, you know, because we had one focus and it was getting fucking curing this disease.
Hey, Hey everyone, I have a new sponsor and I love them. They're called OneSkin. OneSkin. And what is OneSkin? It is skincare. Skincare that is simple. I guess that's the perfect word. It's simple. It you don't have to put on 18,000 products while you're like dying to get in bed. OneSkin was founded by four PhDs dedicated to skin longevity. And this stuff proves you don't need a complicated routine to achieve better skin. Their supplements, they're topical, and they make it easy to help your skin stay younger and healthier without putting all that other shit, I said shit, on your face. And the secret of OneSkin is their OS1 peptide. It's the first ingredient scientifically proven to reduce the buildup of senescent, did you like that? Senescent cells, those little cells that contribute to skin aging. And the fewer amount of cells that they're called zombie cells, that means healthier, younger looking skin, fewer wrinkles, fewer lines, reduced age spots, natural barrier. And that is very important, especially now it's spring and summer and you're going to be out in the sun. So, you know, you love your skin, so do something for it. Return it the favor of having skin and treat it nicely. Does that make sense? Well, so I'm very excited about OneSkin and I haven't gotten my product yet, but I am really, really, really looking forward. So I'm going to be giving you an update on my skin, but you should do it with me. For a limited time, our listeners will get an exclusive 15% off their first OneSkin purchase using the code JUDYGOLD, JUDYGOLD, when you check out at oneskin.co. That's oneskin.co, and it's oneskin.co. You really, really need to invest in your skin. It's very important. So OneSkin, you're going to do this today. You're going to go to oneskin.co. It is more than skincare. It's about skin longevity, targeting the root causes of aging to help you look and feel your best at every age. Get started today with 15% off using code JUDYGOLD at oneskin.co. That's 15% off oneskin.co with code JUDYGOLD. After you purchase, they'll ask you where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them we sent you. It's time to expect more from your skincare routine. Invest in the health of your skin with OneSkin. You're welcome.
Okay, so you go to American Academy of Dramatic Arts. Do you feel normal? Like, oh, my mom's normal?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think so. I didn't feel normal just because of my own
tumult
inside. And I felt like acting was the first time that that was a benefit for me. Because all that stuff that you alluded to, like the secrets and like not the real you, that could come out in theater.
Right. You know? You could become a character and use all that shit. Yeah.
And then people were like, damn, you know, because I had maybe a deeper well to draw on. And a way to finally release it. And that was like a white light moment in my life. You know, I was like, this is it, you know, like I found what I want to do, you know?
That's the best. When I, the first time I did stand up, it was the same thing. It was like, wait, what?
Yep. This is exactly. Yeah.
So you go to the American Academy of Dramatic Art. You're living the life of like a, you know, someone in their young 20s and you're waiting tables. And then you get a job at the Kennedy Center Honors.
Yeah.
And the story that you tell, which is such a great story that really, that, you know, you're a PA, which is, it's the first job in production. It's the bottom. It's like, go get me a fucking cup of coffee. There's no toilet paper. So-and-so needs, you know, whatever. And you just have to go do it, but you still observe and you see what the fuck's going on. So you're at the Kennedy Center Honors and they ask you to hold a French horn. Is that correct?
Yeah.
On the stage. And you're standing there holding this French horn and Aretha Franklin comes out with Billy Preston.
Yep. They hand me a stage manager sees me, thinks I look okay for camera blocking, goes, here, hold this, get on the riser. You know, so I stand on this riser. Across from me is the Washington Gospel Choir. So I'm like, whoa, this is cool. Billy Preston comes out on an organ. Aretha comes out this way. Right. Does a run through. They were doing a tribute to Marianne Williams, who's a
Yeah.
So they do this run through. Don Mischer, who's this huge producer, you know, does the Olympics and all that, says, okay, Aretha, you know, that's kind of okay, but like, do it one more time, like essentially one more time with feeling. And I'm like, I can't believe he just said that to her. And she's pissed. Like, you can see, she's like, okay. You're like, she got mad. So they're like, places, go back from the top. Then she comes back out and she did this song with the fury of like the heavens. You know, it was like she was pulling down lightning bolts and just throwing them on people. And all of a sudden the cameramen are crying, crying. Like, it was the most wonderful, like, expression of emotion and artistic soul I'd ever seen. And I got goosebumps and I was like,
Of course. I mean, come on, that voice.
And I worked with her for many years after that, a bunch of times. I would do like the US Open or whatever. And she always remembered me and called me the goose pimple kid. She's like, you're the goose pimple kid.
Oh, that's.
Because so, that's how I got in the business. And then that took off for me. And I gave up on my own acting aspirations because I started getting this life behind the scenes.
Right. So what can you explain to everyone? What was so, because I love the way you talk about this, what it was about being behind the scenes that you were like, you gravitated to that. Cause so many people are like, the way you talk about that is so much different than anyone else.
You know, it has to do with that childhood, you know, like when all this craziness, like these hippie friends of my mom would always leave these great record collections. So it was like Crosby, Stills and Nash, Jackson Brown, James Taylor. There was a hope in that music that I was like, if I can just hold on and get to that place, everything is going to be okay.
Right.
You know? And then I got to that place. I was Jackson Brown's road manager and CSN and all that. And when in the first couple of times I got behind the scenes, I loved that there was a world back there. You know, it was like that smell of the grease paint. I'm like, wow, it's somebody's job to to stand on a riser.
Right.
And see these, you know, I was so interested in the arts. I knew that like that thing I just seen with Aretha would never be that good on TV. Like, I knew the program would be good, but it wouldn't be that drama I saw.
Right.
How a performance is created and the push and pull, you know, there's conflicting elements that make all this stuff come together.
Right.
And so that addicted, you know.
So you were sort of drawn. It's just interesting psychologically that you're drawn to not what's on the outside, but what's on the inside, like the truth behind, you know, and you wanted to be a part of that instead of the pomp and circumstance of, you know, oh, I'm here with Aretha Franklin. You know, it was more about, wow, this is how things really come together, sort of.
Yes.
I love that because that's exactly who should be behind the scenes. People who do appreciate that and want to be there, you know, in the process.
Can I say one thing to that point? You know, later on when I toured with CSN and all those guys, you know, TV is fancy. You know, I did the daytime Emmys, the Tonys. Right. Like, that stuff is fancy. You go out on the road with a rock band, it's like blue collar. Like, you're with trucks and buses and staying at a Holiday Inn in Columbus or, you know, no offense to Columbus. You know, you're in this like really kind of grind and you see these roadies, you know, the dudes in the shorts.
Oh, yeah.
All this just work that goes on all day, you know, and the band, you see them how they really are. They're just grumpy old men that you're pushing on the stage practically. And then every night the curtain would drop. CSN, for example, would play, you know, do their opening song, carry on. The audience would cheer and I would feel that love that was thrown at them. And I would tear up every time.
Of course.
Just 1 second. And I'd be like, I helped create that. And I knew in that audience, there was some kid who was me 35 years ago, because I got to go to those concerts and I felt that inspiration as a young man and I know how it served me. So I felt like if I was serving something that could help somebody else's life out, you know, then it was righteous, you know?
Right. I get like that at the end of a Broadway show when they do the curtain call.
Right.
I get so teary eyed because you think of all the fucking work that goes into that and people don't realize it. Okay. So you work for the, you do all this, you know, and plus FYI, when you're talking about being on the road with these rock bands, it so reminds me of being a comic on the road in the 80s and in the 90s too. And just going from shithole to fucking shithole, no fucking phone, no fucking computer, you know, just trying to get on stage. And, right. and if the audience sucked at your gig, that was because you 23 hours, you're waiting to get the fuck on the stage. Right. And then the audience sucks. And you're like, I fucking want to kill myself. You know, it's just shit. It's shit.
Imagine.
All right. So you're doing all this. And then you worked with Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
Who you said gave you the creeps.
Yeah. He creeped me out, you know, and I know people love him, but I was a Prince guy, you know, Prince. Was
right. Oh, I love Prince. Yeah.
And I worked with Prince too. It was incredible. But, you know, and I was, you know, I respect Michael Jackson. I was in seventh grade when Thriller came out, you know, but yeah, he was kind of creepy. You know, he was back
you
then.
Know, yeah. No, I was going to say, like, I grew up with the Jackson Five, and right. I, after watching that documentary, I can't listen
right.
to anything, you know, Thriller on without being tainted by that documentary right. because no, there's no way those guys are lying. Why would no. the fuck would they do that?
Well, of course not. No, I totally believe it. And I didn't know, you know, I got in trouble one time. I did a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction with him and he showed up on a cane. And somebody was like, what happened to Michael? And I said, he fell chasing a little boy down the stairs, like just making a joke. And his publicist was like near me, but I still got hired. And he, you know, I did it from the show side, you know, so it wasn't like Michael was calling me up and hiring me. I would get assigned to him. And the last gig I did with him was the VMAs at Lincoln Center. This was 2000, right? And he was my talent. And they made me like shut down the hallway when he walked to stage. So it was like you two had to stay in their dressing room. Nobody could go to stage.
Right.
He was there with Uri Geller, you know, the guy.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, Uri, what are you doing here? He's like, right. I'm Michael's best friend. I'm like, how long have you known him? He's like, 2 weeks. We met on a plane.
And oh, I was like, my weird. God. What the fuck is so weird?
And he had that mask on. He was ahead of his time there.
Oh, yeah. Right.
His nose was gone. Like there was no nose left. And he was tall too. I'm short. I'm 5'7". But like, you know, Michael was taller than most people think. I think somehow they think of him.
Yeah, because I think of him as such a little boy.
Right. No, and he's a tall dude. Like so it was just a weird paradox with that voice. And I just didn't dig it. And I'd been hired to work with him then. And then a Sunday and Monday night at Madison Square Garden. And he was doing like a Jackson reunion, like Jackson special. Yeah. Nobody knew what it was. We didn't have a shooting script. All we knew is that he had hired Marlon Brando and Liza Minnelli to be on the show with him. And I'm like, hey, you know, I went to my boss and I was like, this sounds like a freaking train wreck.
Right.
It was early September. I had just gotten a cabin in Woodstock and I had a cat who loved being up there. I was like, why don't you get me out of this gig? There's a million people that love to work with Michael. Let me get out of this and go up to my cabin. And she was like, fine, you're released. You've done your duty, you know, because he was just a nightmare.
Right.
And I went up to my cabin and I lived downtown at the time, but I was up at the cabin and the night of the taping was September 10th, 2001.
Yeah. It's amazing.
So he'd saved
me. You're so lucky you would have been downtown.
And then he had to drive, of course, across the country with Liza Minnelli and Marlon Brando.
And I love that you said something about, you know, can you imagine being at a fucking gas station in the middle of Kansas and these three walking?
God, I can't believe you literally have everything I've done.
Oh, please. You know, I'm
so honored, Judy.
Oh, stop. Thank you so much for listening to part one of Kill Me Now with the unbelievable Noel Castler. Now, if you like the show, as I say every week, please subscribe and leave a review. I want more reviews and I want them to be 5 stars and I want you to go do it. So I have a lot. I'm feeling unloved. If you haven't purchased my book, yes, I can say that. When they come for the comedians, we're all in trouble. You know, it's every week I mention this. Every week. I just got a new review on Amazon. 5 stars. Wow. It was everything I expected and more. Okay, so what are you waiting for, people? And the audiobook as well is fantastic. Just lower the volume. Anyway, it would really mean a lot to me if you check it out because I need the money. And all the order links are on the homepage of judygold.com or wherever books are sold. Also, please make sure to follow me on Twitter and Instagram for my thoughts about everything, upcoming virtual and live live events. Isn't that hilarious? And dates, that's at Judy Gold, you know, J-E-W-D-Y-G-O-L-D, you know, like Jew, gold, because I'm a Jew, 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 Jew. Anyway, thank you all so much for listening. Stay well, wear a mask. We're almost done with this shit. Fingers crossed, and be well. And if you're traveling and you're on the East Coast, drive carefully. And as we always say, so long.
Don't forget to tune in next week to Just Kill Me Now.
Just Kill Me.
Oh. Don't forget to turn for part two on Just Kill Me.
No, it's not. It's
just Kill Me.
Now.
No, Judy Gold's Just Kill Me. Just Kill Me Now.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.